They made the children walk around in robes while animals were physically abused.
This is the Bible Belt. So to hear that people were worshiping the devil was quite alarming.
A married couple accused of abusing children in the name of Satan.
We were so scared of going to jail for something we didn't do.
The allegations became more lurid. We heard more about burial and cemeteries and death.
Women and children from across the nation come forward with horrifying stories of ritual abuse.
People began to claim that these satanic cults were sacrificing 50,000 children a year.
Eventually, you start thinking, oh my God, what's going on here?
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own. It's America's leading journal, Vanity Fair. Leslie Bennett tells the terrifying story of nightmares on Main Street. Fran Keller loves taking care of children.
When my children were small, I used to babysit, and it gave them kids to play with, and I just love kids. They're always wanting to know something and learn something, and you're there for that.
After her own children left home, Fran opened a licensed daycare center in her three-bedroom house on the outskirts of Austin, Texas, in 1989.
This was a very caring woman who enjoyed working with children, who lived a great life because she was able to do what she liked doing.
On average, six children attend each day, ranging from infants to five-year-olds. While Fran was building the business, her husband, Dan Keller, supervised a road crew for the county until 1990.
Travis County had a layoff, and I was one that got laid off, so I stayed there to help her.
Danny built things out in the yard for the kids to play with. They had a sandbox, a big bird cage he built, and we had a bunch of doves, white doves, that we had gotten from an old country store.
It was the spring of 1991 when three-year-old Christy Chevers started spending several afternoons a month at Fran Keller's daycare.
Christy was a pretty little girl. She reminded me of my grandson. She was a little mischievous at times. I couldn't leave her alone for too long with the other kids because she had this little problem of hitting. And she wasn't quite that good at telling the truth.
Christy's parents, Rick and Suzanne Chevers, are juggling work and childcare and are embroiled in a bitter divorce. Fran wonders if the family's troubles are affecting the child's behavior.
She didn't want to go home a lot of times. She'd throw temper tantrums in the driveway. She just didn't want to go home. She wanted to stay there.
Something obviously was going on. Christy had been doing various bizarre things.
Christy was sort of a troubled young girl, and she had some behavioral problems. She was already being seen by a psychologist for some pretty disturbing behaviors. She would act like a dog and insist on eating out of a bowl. She would try to jump out of cars that were moving. There were incidents where she tried to injure the family pet.
At the time, her mother told me about Christy having a lot of problems, and she was taking her to a therapist. I looked down at Christy and I said, "You're taking this little three-year-old to a therapist?" She never did anything like that at my house.
By mid-August, Christy seems to be settling into the daycare center's routine. Christy's mother picks her up at 1:30 p.m. on August 15th. 1991. But this day turns out to be anything but routine.
Christy was with her mother on their way to a therapy session, and Christy says that she doesn't want to go back to the daycare center. She doesn't like it because Danny, Mr. Keller, had hurt her. She had been spanked. And they get to the therapist's office, and the information moves from being spanked to being sexually abused.
Panicked that Dan Keller has abused her daughter, Suzanne Chevers rushes Christy to the Brackenridge Hospital in downtown Austin.
Dr. Mao, a young emergency room doctor, he had treated children as well as adults. Dr. Mao found what he believed to be medical evidence of sexual abuse.
Suzanne Chevers immediately files charges against Dan Keller. The following day, investigators from the Travis County Sheriff's Office show up at the Keller home.
There was a knock at the door. I opened it up, there's a lady and a man. Never showed me a bench and nothing.
She said Dan's been accused of hurting Christy. I said, what? I said, Dan wouldn't hurt one of these kids. No, that ain't right.
I told him I'd never do something like that.
5 days later, police inform the Kellers that the Chevers have filed another charge. Christy now claims that Fran also touched her.
I couldn't understand. He couldn't understand. And that just broke our heart. It really did.
Police tell the Kellers they will be conducting a full investigation of the child's allegations.
Officially, they were charged with sexual assault of a child.
Neither Fran nor Dan had any criminal history before this. I wouldn't be surprised if either of them have never even had a speeding ticket.
I just couldn't believe it. We both were completely innocent of all of these charges.
The Keller's daycare center shuts down immediately, pending the outcome of the investigation.
When the sheriff's department begins their inquiry, I don't think Fran and Dan had any idea what was going on. I think they were wholly unprepared for how serious it got.
News of the investigation spreads throughout the city of Austin, and the accusations quickly escalate. A second mother from the daycare accuses the Kellers of abusing her child.
Next thing you know, there's another little boy, VJ, who says that he's now been abused by the Kellers.
The boy's mother is alarmed by what she feels is the three-year-old's inappropriate touching at home. When VJ tells her that Dan Keller has hurt him, she immediately calls the police and files charges.
It's the worst feeling in the world when you love kids and for something like that to happen. It destroys you. Mentally, physically, it destroys you.
By October, the parents of VJ and obviously Christy's mother, Suzanne, were convinced that not only were they sexually abused, but they were being ritually abused.
Vanity Fair writer Leslie Bennett began investigating stories of ritual abuse in 1991.
I spent about a year and a half looking into this subject, and it's really disturbing to have to immerse yourself in actual evidence, assuming that these reports aren't all fraudulent, that human beings can do such horrific things, not only to other human beings, but in many cases to children. You can't help but be affected by it.
The claims begin with Fran and Dan and others dressed as werewolves, and they made the children walk around in robes holding candles while animals were physically abused.
It is just the beginning of a living nightmare for the children, their families, and especially Fran and Dan Keller. Even more shocking, dozens of child care workers nationwide are suddenly accused of sexually abusing young children. Have the police uncovered an underground network of child molesters? It's a shocking claim. The owners of a licensed daycare center, Fran and Dan Keller, are accused of sexually abusing children in their care. And they are not alone. By the 1990s, nearly 100 child care workers nationwide are charged with what becomes known as ritual abuse.
It's the latest in what seems to be an epidemic of child abuse in this country.
The escalating panic begins in 1983. When a mother reports to Los Angeles County authorities that her child has been abused at the McMartin preschool.
This was the case that touched off a wave of other child molestation charges across the country.
Experts would eventually claim that 369 children had been molested at just the McMartin school.
The accused include the preschool owner, 76-year-old Virginia McMartin, her daughter, and two grandchildren.
And between 1989 and 1995, 90 children claimed they were abused by people associated with the Little Rascals Daycare Center in Edenton, North Carolina.
The building is now an adult activity center, but the memory of what went on here won't be forgotten.
Eventually, 50 daycare workers across the country are put on trial, accused of abusing the children in their care. The stories the children tell are horrifying and unimaginable. Sordid tales of devil worship, like being forced to watch the beheading of a baby in a church and then drink its blood.
In the 80s, there was what is now identified historically as a satanic panic. People were completely coming unglued. This was on daytime TV constantly. There were bestsellers out. There were movies out.
After satanic ritual abuse became an issue that existed in the public consciousness, people felt obviously protective of their children.
Prosecutors say some of the victims were only 2 years old, and their molesters frightened them into keeping quiet about the abuse by slaughtering small animals in front of them.
You had all these ordinary looking people doing the most bizarre things all across the country. Fran and Dan Keller was just the Texas version of that.
We were quite naive about satanic worship, particularly here in Texas. This is the Bible Belt. So to hear that people were worshiping the devil was quite alarming to us.
Since June, the Kellers have operated what's called a registered family care home in this South Travis County house. The Department of Human Services later revoked the Kellers' registration in August after investigating the first complaint against the couple.
3 months after the allegations of abuse, Fran and Dan Keller are indicted on charges of aggravated sexual assault and indecency with a child.
We were so scared of being separated, going to jail for something we didn't do.
The more we thought about it, the more we thought about it, we got scared. So we went to Las Vegas to see our daughter. I always believe if a person runs, they're guilty. But I changed my mind about that.
I don't know that they had any concept of how bad things were going to get. And frankly, by running, they made it worse for themselves.
By the time the Kellers arrive in Las Vegas, a third child, 4-year-old Brendan Nash, has made similar claims of abuse. Police declare the couple fugitives. Fran and Dan Keller are now wanted criminals. While authorities hunt for the Kellers, the children's allegations become even more bizarre and more disturbing.
Christy says they cut up a dog. They cut a dog's paw off. The same dog was later resurrected, and then it was killed again.
The allegations became more lurid. We heard more about burial and cemeteries and death and killing.
Christy says the children wearing robes, different colored robes, carrying candles, were then made to dig up bodies, dismember them, and sew them back together.
The children, ages 3 and 4, say the Kellers threatened to kill their parents and burn down their homes if they told anyone. It takes more than 3 weeks for law enforcement to track down Fran and Dan Keller.
Well, we were in the motel room, and we were laying in bed, and there's a knock at the door. I opened the door and was facing the gun.
They had guns pointed at me, ready to shoot if I'd made one wrong move. And then I was handcuffed and taken down. It was terrifying. We just kept looking at each other on the way back, knowing we wasn't going to see each other anymore.
The Kellers are arrested on January 14th, 1992, and transported to the Travis County Jail in Austin.
It was like you're born one day and you're dead the next day. Your life's over.
The Kellers' trial starts in November 1992. Prosecutors are confident they have a solid case.
Ultimately, Fran and Dan Keller were charged with aggravated sexual assault of a child for assaulting Christy.
For 20 years, Kenneth Lanning supervised cases involving the sexual victimization of children for the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit.
So now you have to put your case together. You have to be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law. Prosecutors began to realize the benefit of downplaying the satanic ritual abuse aspect of it and just go with the part of the case which they did have some corroboration for.
The day that Christy Shavir's mother reported her daughter's allegations against Dan Keller, the child was examined by Dr. Michael Mao. In his report, Dr. Mao states he found evidence of sexual abuse.
He was the only person who could make a link between this allegation and any possible physical evidence of it.
On the fifth day of the trial, a friend of the Kellers, Doug Perry, takes the stand and delivers an explosive accusation.
Douglas was drug in by the simple fact that he was friends with the Kellers and frequented, to some degree, the daycare center and their home, which was one and the same.
Ultimately, Doug Perry tells them he was involved in an orgy at Fran and Dan's with Christy and some other children. Once Doug Perry's confession was entered into evidence, it was impossible to put that genie back in the bottle.
They read the verdict. I was holding my lawyer's hand real tight because in the holding cell, I'd been saying my Hail Marys. And when the verdict came in guilty, I know my hand just dropped out of his. I just couldn't believe it. It was unbearable.
On November 30th, 1992, Fran and Dan Keller are each sentenced to 48 years in prison.
There were so many cameras there, so many lights going off. We were sitting on opposite sides of the room, and we'd just stare at each other, trying to read each other's minds, I guess, letting each other know we love each other.
By the time the Kellers are sent to prison for what could be the rest of their lives, Vanity Fair writer Leslie Bennett had started her own investigation into satanic ritual abuse.
I was a reporter, and I was talking to a psychiatrist, and she happened to mention that she had started to get an increasing number of patients who were reporting that they were the victims of satanic ritual abuse in childhood. It was, as I recall, shockingly easy to find cases, but they might be leery of talking on the record with their faces out there because they were, in many cases, very scared.
One alleged victim, we'll call her Dr. Susie Burke to protect her real identity, is like many of the women Leslie Bennett's interviewed. She grew up in a small Midwestern town.
And remember, I'm probably 2, 3, 4, 5, I'm not sure exactly. I'm really small. And I see this baby laying on an altar. There are candles all over. I see blood. I just want to get out of there because I start to think they're going to sacrifice her, that they're going to take her blood.
It's a familiar story and strikingly similar to the accounts reported by Leslie Bennett in Vanity Fair.
The psychiatrist said, you know, you get one patient like this and you think they have some form of psychosis. And then you get another patient who lives in a different town and doesn't know the first patient, and they start reporting the same things. And then you get a third, and then you get a fourth. And eventually you start thinking, oh my God, what's going on here?
Throughout the 1980s and early 90s, an alarming number of women come forward, claiming to have been victims of satanic cults and perverse rituals when they were children.
There were a lot more women who came forward than men, but there are a lot more taboos that inhibit men from talking about these things.
Mental health professionals are stunned by what appears to be a hidden epidemic of ritual sexual abuse, so traumatic and unspeakable that many repress their memories just to survive.
I personally interviewed women all over the country from different places and classes and races, and they all relayed similar, very harrowing accounts.
Not all cases involved the same thing, but the most extreme version of it was that they were involved in this widespread human sacrifice. People began to claim that these satanic cults were sacrificing 50,000 children a year.
Satanic ritual abuse involving group sex, black robes, animal, and even human sacrifice.
My interest was finding out whether this phenomenon was something real or was the product of some kind of mass hysteria.
Dr. Susie Burke is like many of the women Leslie Bennett's interviewed. She grew up in a small Midwestern town.
I grew up in a Catholic family. I have three sisters and one brother and myself. I don't remember my dad being around a lot because he worked in the medical profession and he was on call a lot. I think my family on the outside were this loving, caring family. We went to church every Sunday. We did have dinner together in the evenings, but we were often told children should be seen and not heard. So I learned to be quiet a lot. I graduated from high school and I went to nurse's training.
When I first met Susie, the thing that I would think about was her zest, her fire, her spunk. She didn't hold things back. She was totally honest.
When she is 28, Susie marries Tom.
Within a matter of a month or two, she got pregnant, and then approximately 3 years after the birth of the first child, our second baby was born, both daughters. Susie started to get depressed. I could see that she was continuing to struggle with both being involved with me and the children, but also at night having nightmares.
I felt like I was in a black hole and everything was black around me. Then the thought of suicide really became pronounced.
The fact that she admitted to me that she was thinking about suicide scared me to death. And thank goodness, you know, Miguel was on the other line.
Susie reaches out to a friend and mentor for help, psychologist Miguel Martinez, her college professor.
She was hurting, she was pretty lost. And so for me, it's what can I do to help that person?
Dr. Martinez and Susie begin weekly therapy sessions. He encourages her to explore her hazy childhood memories.
He said, let your unconscious mind go where it needs to go. I did that. And that's the first image of the little girl, probably 2, 3 maybe, in the back room of a bar. I can still see it, with her pants wrapped around her ankle with these strange people there. And it was the bar that my father used to go to with his cronies. I know that this was me.
It seemed to me that she was describing what most people would describe as sexual abuse.
When I realized that my father was involved in the abuse and allowing people to hurt me, I absolutely could have shot him, but he was already dead. I believe my mother let this happen to me. I think she decided it was better to be in the house than homeless.
There is no direct evidence to prove Susie's claims, but there is also no question that her recollections are so vivid and painful, they continue to haunt her.
There has been such a historical tendency to discount personal testimony, particularly when it comes from women. And often history proves that they weren't lying or imagining it, that certain bad things really did happen.
I can't understand, through years of therapy, that this was really about more than just sexual abuse. This was about ritual abuse. I have learned to call it ritual abuse because when you say satanic ritual abuse, people really get nervous. The memories are horrific. I didn't want to believe them.
Memories that Dr. Martinez and Susie begin to slowly piece together during her therapy sessions. One memory in particular haunts her to this day.
I all of a sudden was down in a church basement. I remember feeling like I couldn't move, I couldn't talk, I couldn't open my eyes, but I could hear people around me. I was, I think, drugged and anesthetized. And all of a sudden I'm hearing instruments and I realized that they actually had performed an abortion on this person, which when I say person, I mean me. I was probably like 13.
One girl that I talked to had been repeatedly impregnated, she said, and the fetuses were removed from her and used in satanic rituals. One woman remembered her twin being killed in a ritual where they cut her heart out while she was living.
I kept saying, this isn't true. This is so shameful. I was so ashamed.
Some of the women that I talked to, you know, one had all kinds of scars and marks on her body, including one that seemed to be a brand. Was this because of satanic ritual abuse? Or did she just have crazy, sadistic parents or relatives who were doing, you know, unspeakable things to her?
All I can say is I know what happened to me. This happened to me.
So when people ask me, can I prove it? I say, I can't. My focus is trying to deal with the negative effects of trauma and helping people heal so they can live a richer, fuller life.
I've worked so hard to be at peace, but I feel compelled to add my voice to the people who say this has happened to them.
Leslie Bennett spent nearly 2 years talking to alleged victims who claim they were abused.
I have never in my entire journalistic career had another story besides this one where I looked into something for a really long time and did a lot of reporting and ended up not knowing any more than I did when I started. I have no idea if this stuff was real, even now. It's haunting.
I began to question what was happening here. As I worked with law enforcement to investigate these cases, no matter what the investigators did, they were simply unable to corroborate certain aspects of these cases.
In 1992, Kenneth Lanning issues an official government report that concludes satanic ritual abuse cannot be substantiated.
If all of that was going on and we can't find any evidence of it, it would have to be the greatest crime conspiracy in the history of mankind. But it's important to understand as you look at these cases that we had come out of centuries of denial about sexual victimization of children. Some of these children may have been victimized, but just not in the way that they're describing.
Long after most of the ritual abuse cases are dismissed, Fran and Dan Keller remain in Texas prisons. accused of ordering children at their daycare to engage in satanic rituals. They were convicted of aggravated sexual assault.
I got on that bus to go to prison. And we're leaving, I looked out that window towards Franny's. I said, bye, baby, I'll see you.
Unwilling to admit any wrongdoing, the Kellers have been denied parole three times. Fran, now 56 years old, is determined to prove their innocence.
I wrote every attorney that I could get a hold of. I don't think there's anyone I didn't write.
Eventually, Austin attorney Keith Hampton agrees to review their case.
The whole thing is very surreal. The investigation became a real witch hunt by credulous police officers who actually believed these ever wilder stories that were being told.
What Keith Hampton uncovers will shock everyone involved in the Kellers case.
Now you show me what Danny does at the daycare to Chris.
Fran and Dan Keller are sent to Texas prisons in 1992 for a crime they say they did not commit. Attorney Keith Hampton has taken up their case.
I found a drawing of Jesus in the file. That's from the jail. And Dan put in the quote about, they know not what they do, forgive them. And I asked him about that, and that's when he told me inmates were seething. The guards despised him. Everybody believed that he was taking a 3.5-year-old girl and doing these horrific things. They believed it. Dan narrowly escaped from being murdered.
It's really hard. It's really hard just living, trying to keep your sanity, knowing somebody tried to kill your husband in prison. Hardcore prison more than once.
Fran, I mean, she lived in complete terror and had many horrible things done to her because people believe this stuff. There was no criminal history involved with either Fran or Dan. There was absolutely nothing in their background that would even suggest that these are child molesters. They're two normal people. Where did the train go off the tracks in this case?
Hampton finds the interviews with 3-year-old Christy Chevriers especially disturbing. He brings in child abuse experts to examine the tapes.
From the moment I saw those videotapes, I saw red flags.
Veteran social worker Vivian Lewis is now a child abuse expert for the United States Department of Defense.
I believe the interviewer in this case asks a number of leading questions, unfairly leading questions.
Now you show me what Danny does at the daycare to Christy. Can you show me?
What you show me?
You show me.
Can we vote?
18 of the top experts in the world gave me a letter in the end that confirmed that these kids were the victims of suggestive questioning. It can result in the children insisting that they have memories of events that absolutely never happened.
Hampton's review uncovers another disturbing detail, the damning testimony of the Keller's friend, Doug Perry. His confession appears to have been coerced.
Ultimately, Doug Perry comes out of this interrogation with confessing to being involved in an orgy at Fran and Dan's with Christy and some other children, but then he immediately recants it.
He was very scared, and literally, he folded. And when he folded, he drug a lot of people down with him.
They put him on the stand over his protest. The judge ordered him, under threat of being jailed, to read the confession. So he read it and then told the jury none of this stuff is true.
But recanting his confession on the witness stand does not convince the jury. After the killers are convicted, Doug Perry pleads guilty to indecency with a child and is sentenced to 10 years probation. He receives counseling from Vivian Lewis.
He certainly wasn't a pedophile, and I think that he was abused by the system. Doug was scared. He literally told me, I wanted out of there so bad, I'd tell them anything they wanted to hear.
The adults in the room, the police and the prosecutors, the ones that were supposed to take this situation, look at it, and insert some rationality into the process, completely all lost their minds. And in so doing, prosecuted and convicted wrongly a couple for a crime that never happened.
How do I prove they're not guilty? I mean, what else more do you want? There's no DNA. This is not a DNA case.
Convinced the Kellers are innocent, Hampton is determined to track down the physician who testified about the most critical piece of evidence presented at trial. And he discovers that the doctor has been keeping a terrible secret for more than 20 years. At the sexual abuse trial of Fran and Dan Keller, Dr. Michael Mao provided the most critical testimony in the case, the medical evidence that 3-year-old Christy Chevriers was sexually abused. More than 20 years after the trial, attorney Keith Hampton finally confronts Dr. Mao about his conclusions.
He and I met at a restaurant. He said, I testified in the Kellers trial, and I was wrong. I was mistaken. And I didn't know what I was talking about.
He completely recanted. He said that he was a young doctor. He didn't have any specific training in doing assault examinations, particularly on children.
And I said, you're gonna have to give an affidavit, you know? And so he did. Throughout this time, he was very regretful and wanting to right what he later came to understand was a wrong. Once I got agreement on the false evidence claim, I went and got a judge to sign a bond because their due process rights were violated.
Nearly 21 years to the day after she was sent to prison, Fran Keller, now 63, is finally released.
If I could have grabbed a tree and kissed it, I would have.
10 days after her release, Fran is waiting for Dan outside the county jail.
They hadn't seen each other for 21 years. I think they were both in a state of shock.
I walked out the door, and there was Keith. He tried to comb my hair down, and I said, where's Fran? I said, Fran, come on.
Oh, when he came out of the jail, he looked so scrawny. He was walking with a cane. He didn't have his full whiskers and beard and mustache because they didn't allow it. And I just looked at him. I thought I was going to cry. But he was mine. He was mine.
Today, the couple has a lot of hope for the future.
So, we're free.
I'm only 63. I've got another 30, 40 years to go. I'm just as happy as can be.
On May 20th, 2015, the Court of Criminal Appeals vacates the convictions of Fran and Dan Keller.
They're free from prison, but they're not free from their circumstances.
They spent literally their prime earning years in prison. They shop at food banks. They donate blood for money.
We have to register as sex offenders. We cannot be around any children under 16 without another adult. We can't apply for jobs to help make ends meet.
We've lost everything that we worked for.
What I wanted and still haven't gotten for them is exoneration. They have not been declared to be innocent.
The only person that can fix it now is the district attorney, and she has just been so incredibly reluctant to do so.
We had a meeting. She left and could only say that she couldn't find a path to innocence.
The district attorney's office did not respond to requests for a statement clarifying their position on the Kellers case.
I think one of the most sort of significant things about this case is how quickly things can completely fall apart.
In many of these cases, what I saw is people who were, at least by my definition, overzealous. They just had a desperate need to validate and believe victims.
This case was a perfect example of hysteria and what it can do. People should remember this case because it's going to happen again.
Mentally, we're still locked up because we still have this hanging over our head, the felony, the accusation.
Despite everything they've been through, Fran and Dan Keller remain optimistic, and they cherish each other more than ever.
If you can be separated from your spouse for 21 years and then pick it up as if you never missed a beat, that's pretty impressive.
I thought I'd never be separated from this man. It was horrible.
How come you love me so much?
Because you're sexy.
Yeah. We're good people. We mean no harm to nobody. We don't have no hate in our hearts. And we believe in God and do our best to walk with Him.